On this Father's Day, I want to revisit an old story, a popular one, one that you have read before, but one that needs to be read again and again, about the father of our faith. First, a bit of context. It was about 2,000 years ago that Jesus came to earth and walked among us. And I think in your mind's eye, you can picture just a bit of what the culture was at that time, of what worship was in society and culture, and how drastically different it was than our time today. Take another 2,000-year step back in history, that same span of time, farther back, 2,000 years before Christ walked the earth. That is when Abraham was. That is when God called Abraham and started the story of our faith. And so life was different then. Society was very different. Culture was very different. Worship was very different. Religion was very different. The heart of man, very much the same. God, the same. Everything else, very different. So as we go to this story, keep that in mind. The distance, the time, the very different time and culture in which Abraham lived. His story begins in Genesis chapter 12. The Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So Abram went, as the Lord had told him. God gave Abram a call and a three-part promise. There would be land, there would be blessing, and there would be a great nation. And if there's any doubt about how this great nation was to come, verse 7, "Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, 'To your offspring I will give this land.'" Abram was to be a father. He was 75 years old when the call came. He was not a father yet, but God said he would be, the father of a great nation. So he went. And he didn't get in a plane or get in his car, but he gathered his herds and his herdmen, and he packed up tents, and he brought supplies, and he walked. This was a long journey. So while we just turn the page and arrive, a lot had happened. A lot of time had passed. It was an adventure. It was a journey. But they got there. They arrived, Abram and his wife Sarai and his nephew Lot, and all of their clan and herdsmen that they had brought with them. And there began to be some strife between Lot's herds and Abram's herds, and they decided it's time to split. If we're going to settle here, you know, Abram said, "Lot, you pick your spot, and I'll go the other way. We'll spread out. We'll put some distance between us, and we will settle in this good land." Chapter 13, verse 14, "The Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, 'Lift up your eyes and look to the place where you are, northward and southward, eastward and westward, for all the land that you will see, I will give to you and to your offspring forever. I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth, so that if one can count the dust of the earth, your offspring also can be counted." The point is, you can't count it. So immense will be the nation that will descend, that Abraham was to be the father of. So he's in this land. He listened to God. He went, he followed, he arrived. God gave him the promise again. And now it seems it's time to settle down and raise a family and see the promise fulfilled. But no, not yet. In chapter 14, we see that the kings of a bunch of the small city-states in this territory gathered together, and they went to possess Sodom and Gomorrah, the land that Lot had settled in. And they took Lot as their possession as well. And when Abram heard this, he went to rescue him, and he gathered together some allies. So he'd been there a while. He had made some friends of the neighbors that he had settled near, and they gathered together, and they went and they rescued Lot. And after rescuing Lot, Abraham received a blessing from the priest Melchizedek. In chapter 15, we hear, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram, I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great. But Abraham had a question. Abram said, oh, Lord God, what will you give me? I continue childless. The heir of my house is Eleazar of Damascus. And Abram said, behold, you have given me no offspring. Abram saying, I believe you, but where's the promise? And God said in verse 4, this man shall not be your heir. Your very own son shall be your heir. And he brought him outside and said, look toward the heaven, number the stars if you are able. And then he said, so shall your offspring be. And Abram believed the Lord, and he counted it to him as righteousness. And then God commands this covenant sacrifice, and he took these animals and he split them and he walked between them. And this is one of those things that 4,000 years removed makes no sense to us. But here's what I want you to hear. God said to do it, and Abram did. And then between chapter 15 and 16, 10 years passed. We don't know all that happened in that 10 years, but we find out right away that Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, not in those 10 years, and so they came up with a plan. Another thing we're 4,000 years removed from, but the custom at that time, Sarai gave Abraham one of her maidservants and said, we can have an heir through her. And so Abram took her as a wife, and she conceived. The end of chapter 16, Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to Abram. Between chapter 16 and 17, another 13 years pass. We don't know what happened in the 13 years. We don't know how they felt. We don't know what level of despair and disappointment was felt. We don't know what prayers were prayed, and we don't know what else God had said. But in chapter 17, when Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to him and said, I am El Shaddai, God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless, that I may make my covenant between me and you and may multiply you greatly. And Abram fell on his face. And God said to him, behold, my covenant is with you. You shall be the father of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham. For I have made you the father of a multitude of nations, and I will make you exceedingly fruitful. Layers of the promise. Years and years apart, but still he would be a father with Sarah. Sarai's name also changed to Sarah, and in verse 15 and 16, God says, I will bless her, and moreover, I will give you a son by her. And as a sign of this covenant and this layer of promise, God initiates the custom of circumcision with Abraham. And this is the first time we hear of it in our religious history and in our story. Circumcision was not new. It was something that happened throughout the ancient Near East and in Africa. In general, it was a rite of passage from boyhood to manhood. It symbolized that this boy was now ready to be a warrior and to marry. God initiates a rite that was different with Abram, that this was something to happen now and to happen for boys on the eighth day after they were born. So God gives Abraham a command, asks him to do something in response as a covenant, and he does. It says that very same day. We don't know how much later, but there's another layer of the promise. He's sitting in the tent, and three men come, and he recognizes them, and he runs to them, and he bows down to the earth, and he invites them in, and he prepares a meal. And they said to him in chapter 18, verse 9, where is Sarah, your wife? And Abraham said, she is in the tent. And the Lord said, I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, shall have a son. Again, the promise comes, but Sarah is listening by the door of the tent. And it says in verse 11, Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in years. The way of women had ceased to be with Sarah. Not only had she not had a child up until the time that we hear Abraham was 75 years old, but even after the promise, it had been about 25 years, no child. This barren woman has now gone through menopause, and these men are saying that in a year, she would have a son. And she laughed to herself, saying, after I'm worn out and my Lord is old, shall I have this pleasure? And the Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh and say, shall I indeed bear a child now that I am old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? And so with this layer of promise, we hear that while this may seem unlikely, impossible even, anything is possible with God. And now we have a timeline. In 1 year. And it's an eventful year, because if you look at the rest of chapter 18 and 19, we see that God came and destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, but that Abraham intercedes on behalf of Lot and the righteous that might still be dwelling in the city, and about how God rescued Lot and his daughters, but his wife turned into a pillar of salt. It's a big year. It's a big year. Chapter 21. Verse 1, the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did to Sarah as he had promised. And Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age at the time of which God had spoken to him. So after years and years of promise and covenant, God asking him to do something and Abraham doing it, it came to pass. And I love the description of this event and the ones to follow. This is a book I happened to read this past week, The Pursuit of God by A.W. Tozer, and he describes this historical event in a very vivid way that I want to share today. Abraham was old when Isaac was born, old enough even to have been his grandfather. And the child became at once the delight and idol of his heart. From that moment when he first stooped to take the tiny awkward form in his arms, he was an eager love slave to his son. God went out of his way to comment on the strength of his affection, and it is not hard to understand. The baby represented everything sacred to his father's heart, the promises of God, the covenants, the hopes of the years, the long dream. And as he watched him grow from babyhood to young manhood, the heart of the old man was knit closer and closer with the life of his son until at last the relationship bordered upon the perilous. It was then that God stepped in to save both father and son from the consequences of an uncleansed love. From chapter 22, take now thy son, said God to Abraham, thine only son Isaac, whom thou love, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of. The sacred writer spares us a close-up of the agony that night on the slopes near Beersheba when the aged man had it out with his God. But respectful imagination may view in awe the bent form and the convulsive rustling alone under the stars. How should he slay the lad? Even if he could get the consent of his wounded and protesting heart, how could he reconcile the act with the promise? In Isaac shall thy seed be called. This was Abraham's trial by fire, and he did not fail in the crucible. While the stars still shone like sharp white points above the tent where the sleeping Isaac lay, and long before the gray dawn had begun to lighten the east, the old saint had made up his mind. He would offer his son, as God had directed him to do. Picking up with that story, in Genesis chapter 2, verse 3, Abraham arose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac. And he cut the wood for the burnt offering, and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, pause, the third day, 3 days of putting one foot in front of the other toward the last place in the world he wanted to go, with his son beside him, knowing what was before him. On the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. And then Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship and come to you again." And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac, his son. And he took in his hand the fire and the knife. And so they went, both of them together. And Isaac said to his father Abraham, "My father." And he said, "Here I am, my son." And he said, "Behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Abraham said, "God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son." And so they went, both of them together. And when they came to the place of which God had told him, Abraham built the altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac, his son, and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." And he said, "Here I am." And he said, "Do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. And so Abraham called the name of that place, "The Lord will provide." And as it is said to this day, "On the mount of the Lord it shall be provided." And the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, "Behold, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you. And I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of the heaven and as the sand that is on the seashore. And your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies. And in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." It's a long story and a significant one, and one that we're invited to enter into and to live in our lives. Perhaps you have your own experience with a story. I have my own experience. When I was a new mom, I had a mommy blog. I was a blogger, and I wrote posts about crafts that I did and things that I baked and decorations in my house and lots of pictures of the cutest baby. And I had a bit of a following that I had gathered. And I came to realize that if I was going to have a following and if I was going to put effort into this blog, I wanted it to mean something. And so I started to have posts about prayer and reading scripture and how mommyhood informed my faith. But I noticed one day that the tags on the site, so when you write a post, you assign tags to it so that if someone searches on the internet for these topics, they might ping to your post. But also on my website, I had a column on the side so that frequent tags that I use, the topics that I talked about a lot, were there. And if it was something I talked about a lot, then the little button to direct you to those specific posts got bigger and bigger. So the big buttons were the things I talked about the most, and the smaller buttons were the things not quite as often. And I noticed one day that the Josiah button was, like, big. It was a big button. And the God button was pretty small. And on the one hand, that requires no apology because it was a mommy blog and it was about baby stuff. But through this recognition, my heart was convicted, and God asked me a question. If this blog represents your life, if this is how you are putting yourself out to the world, is it right that Josiah should be so much bigger than God and I wrote a post about it, which I went back and looked up this week. The post was called Why Josiah is Bigger Than God. And I just confessed that if I were asked at that point in my life, would you sacrifice your son on the altar? I would say absolutely not. My honest admission, nope. I love Josiah more than I love God, more than I would trust that that's the truth. And I came roundabout to another conclusion, that God wasn't really asking me to love my son less. I was just supposed to love God more. And so at the end of my post, I copied it down here today, I said, I guess maybe I hope that someday, somewhere down the line, one of you will ask me, do you love God more? And I pray that my answer will be yes. I do not believe that the day will ever come that I will be asked to sacrifice my son on an altar. That makes no sense today. But I do believe that someday, in one way or another, I will be asked a similar question. Are you going to hold on to him? Or are you going to let God? Fast forward. We moved to the ranch, and internet speeds were not what they had been, and I gave up blogging. Fast forward some more. When Josiah was going into second grade, I decided to keep him home for homeschool, and I've asked him for permission to share this part of his story that overlaps with my story. Sometimes it can be tough to be a little boy in Atkinson, Nebraska, if sports aren't your thing. And there's a lot of social pressure, even as a first grader, to be someone else and something else. And in second grade, this time in my life, I was available to be home with my son. And I knew, I was pretty confident before going into it, that a home learning environment was going to be good for him. And throughout the year, I had that supposition confirmed over and over again. It was wonderful. We read such good books, and we had such good conversations, and the load of pressure just lifted. It wasn't so much of a surprise, necessarily, that this would be good for Josiah, but what did surprise me was how good it was for me, too. I loved homeschooling. But also that year, we started our business downtown, and it came to be, spare you all the details that really aren't relevant to the story, but every day our expenses were about 2 to 3 times what we were bringing in, and it was clear that we needed to do something pretty drastic. And I was the one who needed to help Rod implement these changes. And if I were to devote the time and energy that was necessary to that, I would not be able to do homeschool for third grade. And I had this long conversation with God about it in the car. It was a long drive with sleeping kids in the back seat, just me in the front seat, and tears streaming down my face. And I just talked it out with God and weighed the pros and the cons. I told him that I was pretty sure I knew what he wanted me to do, but that it wasn't what I wanted to do. And asked him over and over again, are you sure? Because this feels so right, and I feel like I'm smack dab in the middle of your purpose for my life, and this is what I want to do, and it's so fulfilling, and I love it, and I don't want to change it. And mostly, though, my heart was stuck on my little boy and what would be best for him. And could I really give up what's best for him for this other thing? Was it really what God wanted me to do? And as I drove, I recalled the blog post. Someday, one way or another, I would be asked, are you going to hold on to him? Or are you going to let God? And I said, but God, nobody loves him like I do. And God, I don't know how this happens, but he took me by the shoulders and he gave me a little shake and he said, I do. because there is a greater love, an open-handed love that's bigger. And on our end, there's a truer worship, and there's a greater faith, and there's a pure belief, a faith that can withstand the test, like Abraham's. And in so many ways, this comparison that I'm making is silly, and I know that. How's sending your kid to public school for third grade anything like sacrificing him on an altar? The gravity of the situation, worlds apart, no doubt. But I think sometimes we belittle our struggles and our emotions. And to belittle what we're going through is a disservice to the way that God might use them to shape our heart and to invite him into our story that is his story. And through this experience of mine and that long, tearful prayer in the car and God's arms reaching through the veil to me, I was invited to enter Abraham's story and to be tested alongside him. And it was quite a test. And there are several Old Testament and New Testament passages since this story that clarify for us and help us to discern what test it was that Abraham passed. Because it wasn't that Abraham is called the father of our faith. It wasn't that he was counted as righteous because his sacrifice was good. Abraham was counted as righteous because of his willingness to obey, because of the proper alignment of his priorities. Because when God said, do this, over and over again, he did it. Faith like Abraham's obeys God completely. And faith like Abraham's surrenders what's most precious to us to God. And faith like Abraham's waits on the Lord to provide. And I don't just mean to provide the ram in the nick of time and to hold out hope that that will always happen for each of us in our life, because sometimes waiting for God for the patience of his promise actually means being okay with what he provides that's different than what we might have expected the outcome to be. Like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, when they were to be sent into the fiery furnace, and they said, God can save us. Our God is able to deliver us from this fire. And they proclaimed it for all who could hear. And after this proclamation, though, they said three very significant words. But if not, still we will not worship your God. And the author of Hebrews tells us that Abram went through a similar experience of giving up his own desires and seeking God's. It says that Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was in the act of offering up his only son, of whom it was said, through Isaac shall your offspring be named. How did he come to the conclusion that he could do this? Well, verse 19, he considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead. He knew God. He said, if God's asking me to do this, then the promise will come about in another way. In Romans chapter 4, verse 20, Paul says, no unbelief made Abraham waver concerning the promise of God, but he grew strong in his faith, and he gave glory to God, fully convinced that God was able to do what he had promised. This is why his faith was counted to him as righteousness. On Mother's Day, I spoke about the names or titles that are used of God throughout the Old Testament. But Abba, the Hebrew word for father, was not one of them. I don't know if you recognize that. Here's the thing. In the timeline of history as we see it from our earthly perspective, that was not how they understood God. You're not a father until you have a son. After Jesus came to earth, we began to see God not only as Jesus' father, but as our father. Myron led us in the Lord's Prayer this morning. Our Father, Jesus taught us to pray. And because we have the story of Abraham, a human father with whom we can relate and alongside whom we can agonize when we're asked to sacrifice the things in our life that are bigger than God, alongside Abraham, we're invited to then enter the very heart of God, the Father, and to grasp in some small but also big way his incomprehensible love for us. In Matthew chapter 26, we find Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. Verse 37 says, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Jesus knew what was coming. He'd been telling people all along. But at this point, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. And Jesus said to them, my soul is very sorrowful, even unto death. Remain here and watch with me. And going a little farther, he fell on his face and prayed, saying, my Father, Abba, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. And a few verses later, again for a second time, he went away and prayed, Abba, Daddy, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done. And on the cross, passers-by spoke out to Jesus and said, if you're the Son of God, come down from the cross. And calling into question God's love for his Son, some said, if he trusts in God, so let God deliver him now, if he desires. He said he is the Son of God. They're saying if his Father loves him, he wouldn't let this happen. But he did. How could a father do this to his son? Because there is a greater love. John chapter 3, verse 16. For God so loved the world that he gave his son, his only son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life.